and changes during the year of the budget that was adopted last July. And so there is this entire focus and apparatus that deals with that. The Department of Finance is largely in the driver's seat on that. The Joint Legislative Budget Committee is the way the legislature gets involved in that. And that's how the two branches of government deal with what they did last year. But that is terribly important because there are literally endless debates and discussions about who meant what in the budget that was adopted last year and that governs the spending in all areas of government today. Simultaneous with that, the administration is, and now the legislature because of where we are in the process, is debating what it is we ought to be doing starting on July 1st of this calendar year going to June 30th of next year. And simultaneous with both of those, the Department of Finance, every department, every agency, and certain members of the legislature are thinking about what should the governor be proposing and how should the legislature try to influence that proposal that will be made available to the public and the legislature January 10th of 2006 and won't become law at the earliest until July 1st, 2006 for the 2006-2007 year. So there are 3 years being worked on simultaneously, only one of which do we really know what the rules of engagement are, and the second of which it tries to get clearer as we move towards a budget, and the other one, it is highly conceptual. Now, most of the time when people talk about the budget process, they talk about what I'm going to talk about now, and that is the budget that the Department of Finance and all the agencies and so on work on most of the summer and the fall, and then give up essentially Thanksgiving, Christmas, and other holidays, and get it together so that the governor can, following the State of the State address on the 6th, 7th, or 8th of January, the governor can propose to the legislature by constitutional deadline on January 10th the budget. So that is the first requirement under the law. Governor has to show up with a budget on January 10th and submit it to the legislature. The only requirement really in that budget is that it be balanced. So when people say there's a requirement for a balanced budget in California, the only real requirement is that the proposal is balanced. There's not a requirement that the adopted budget is balanced. It is that it is proposed that it is balanced. Here's the difficulty that the governor runs into, and it really manifests itself in two ways. Number one, about 80% of the budget is predetermined, whether the governor is Arnold Schwarzenegger or Gray Davis or anybody else, about 80% of the budget is predetermined. That is a function of a whole lot of things, but largely it is ballot box budgeting by all of us, deciding that, you know, it's a great thing to spend a certain very large percentage of the budget on education. It's also a function of a number of smaller decisions voters have made about ballot box budgeting, and it is very much about the fact that you don't really have a choice of whether or not the state of California is going to run a health and human services program operated at the county levels but funded largely by the federal government. We are not really going to have a debate about whether or not we have a Medi-Cal program, which is the implementation of the federal Medicaid program. We're not going to really have a debate in California about whether or not we're going to have a TANF program. Those aren't really debates. You may decide it should be this big instead of this big. Okay, did you see my hands move? That's about the debate. The debate's about this big or this big. But it is not whether or not we have one, because you can't not have one. It's probably illegal not to have one, but it certainly would be, shall we say, politely uncivilized not to have health and human service programs. So about 80 plus or minus percent of the budget is predetermined. So the second big issue for the governor is, you know, in that 20% arena, what is it you want to advance or retard or expand or contract? And those debates are fairly limited as well, largely driven by court precedent, largely driven by what you know is even at all possible to be done in the legislature. Now, the second big area which is constraining on any governor when he proposes this budget is the fact that it is so hard to predict what it is going to happen in the fiscal year you're talking about. The governor and his staff are preparing this budget that is released on January 10th. That is the culmination of 6 or 7 months worth of work predicting caseloads and revenues that you expect are going to take place in a 12-month period starting 7 months in the future. So about as good a guess as you get is you get these binoculars and you look out there in the future and say, you know, in about a year, I think the economy is going to do this, this, or this. And our sales tax revenue will be at this point, and our personal income tax will be this, and the component part of the personal income tax that is reflected by capital gains is going to be this. And I think that what's going to happen also on caseloads in health and human services will be... I mean, it's a step and a half ahead of guesswork. But in fairness, these people are very good at it. They're extraordinarily good at it. People in the Department of Finance, Legislative Analyst's Office, who work on these things, they are extraordinarily good at it. But it just suffers from how far out in advance you need to try to do this. So the governor then proposes on January 10th. There is an appearance of a bunch of activity that takes place right away. The legislative analyst comes out about around Valentine's Day with a little love note back to the administration. It says, here's what we think of the budget. And Ledge Analyst's Office is a nonpartisan, completely independent, absolutely wonderful entity that does terrifically good work and sends this little Valentine back over to the governor and says, have you thought of this, 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 and this? The legislature, meantime, is starting to hold committee hearings, subcommittees of the Assembly Committee on Budget and the Senate Committee on Budget begin taking the budget and hearing it. Now, this is where there's been a big change in life in the legislature. It used to be, when Mr. Naylor was the leader in the Assembly, the Republican side, and, frankly, prior to term limits, and this is not a good term limits, bad term limits argument, it's just a difference culturally in what's happening with the budget. It used to be that the budget process was an iterative process. The governor proposed a budget. It was introduced in both houses of the legislature. The subcommittee started to meet, and their job was to narrow the issues, was to get agreement not only between Republicans and Democrats, but between the Assembly and the Senate. Because I think one of the underreported, undertold stories is that it is at least almost as hard to get the Assembly and the Senate to agree on the budget as it is Republicans and Democrats in the Assembly or Republicans and Democrats in the Senate. And what used to happen is that the subcommittee process was an iterative process of narrowing the number of issues that were truly in dispute, so that you could get to, next step, conference committee. Just before the conference committee meets, the governor releases through the Department of Finance, after the legislature's been going through an iterative process of subcommittee hearings, which these days is largely an exercise in talking about the budget. No one in the process any longer feels terribly constrained by the acts of the part of the process that immediately preceded them. So the subcommittees do work, but they no longer believe that their work will be respected by the next step in the process. So what happens is, in May, the governor and Department of Finance have much better information for projecting revenues and caseloads because they've gotten the personal income tax in and they've gotten another quarter's worth of sales tax in. And so that, given that the two big drivers of the general fund are sales tax, state share sales tax, and personal income tax, and you've got real numbers, then you adjust that together with the real caseload experience during that same period of time. The forecast gets a whole lot better. And as you know, and it's not fair to ask anybody in the Department of Finance or the governor's office or the legislature to admit this, but, you know, every smart governor understates their revenue, overstates their caseload in January, so that when you get to the May revise, if something bad happens, you're not caught worse off, hopefully, and you're usually caught a little better off. So what happens at this point is that this becomes the real debate around the budget. And customarily, in a, let's call it a $100 billion budget, what is that debate is something between 1 and 4%. The legislature and the governor are literally arguing over, debating, discussing $1 to $4 billion in a $100 billion budget. That is all that really can ever be at issue. It may revise helps focus what that amount is about, and the conference committee helps focus what those issues are about. Conference committee is a couple of Republicans and a Democrat, a couple of Democrats and a Republican, you only wish, Mr. Naylor, a couple of Democrats and a Republican from the Assembly, a couple of Democrats and a Republican from the Senate. They get together, six members in open session, and go through the budget. What they used to do was only deal with those issues where there was literally not a penny's worth of difference or a word worth of difference on that issue between the Senate and the Assembly. Now what it is very customary to have what's called an open budget process, where irrespective of whether or not there has been agreement between the Senate and the Assembly, Republicans, it doesn't matter, every issue's open. Again, not any respect for the iterative nature of the process. It also is the place where the two-thirds vote issue starts really sinking into people's consciousness about what is real and what is not real to try to get done. Conference committee then does the best it can to get a document, hopefully sometime prior to June 1st, so that there's a couple of weeks worth of time for if the big five need to meet, leaders of Republicans and Democrats in the Assembly and the Senate, plus the governor. And again, in the good old days, which weren't so good, that was really down to just a few issues that needed to be resolved. Now, the big five, it is not clear what they do. It is not clear whether they want to have a lot of issues, don't want to have a lot of issues, what other issues are going to be drawn into the political equivalent of a black hole in the sense of everything is just sucked into that discussion or not. And that's very situational. What ends up happening then is that there's the long, hot summer. And what rises to the top of that is the two-thirds vote requirement that California has that other states, by and large, don't have. All states except for California and Rhode Island have a simple majority vote requirement to adopt a budget in both houses and send it to the governor. In this state, we require two-thirds vote. That is neither good nor bad. It is what it is. It does disproportionately leverage into the conversation issues that would otherwise not rise to that level of significance or leverage. Example, almost always, and especially during any kind of good economic times, Republicans, correctly from their point of view, will always hold out for a tax cut of some kind as the price of getting a budget. It's neither good nor bad, it just is what it is. But it is a feature of the fact that there's a two-thirds vote requirement. Issues that you're going to hear talked about today with these folks then feed into that process, whether they are the volatility of the tax, major tax systems, or the two-thirds vote requirements, some of these other issues that will arise. As you know, at the very end of the process, and this is something that the legislature is painfully aware of, the governor bats last. The governor does in California and does not have this authority in many other states. The governor in California has the blue pencil authority to be able to reduce or eliminate any proposed spending. The governor cannot raise spending, and the governor cannot change the conditions of the spending. But the governor can either eliminate or reduce the spending. And when that exercise is completed and people fall down in a heap and are just glad that it's over, they realize that they are still now starting into another one of those, and these 3 years simultaneously are happening. Thank you.
Fred, that was a great introduction. I had a depressing moment on the train down this morning. I realized that this is my 27th budget cycle since first getting elected to the legislature. Since leaving the legislature, I've been part of the long-named law firm you heard. And we have clients, local government clients. We have major transportation clients. We have healthcare provider clients. and other clients that are seriously interested in the budget process that benefit from it or are hurt by it. And so in my law practice, every January 10th, we can't wait to get our hands on the budget. And I'm on the phone or emailing a variety of clients about what the governor proposed. And in February, we can't wait to get our hands on the ledge analyst analysis of the budget. And then the May revise, same kind of a cycle. So I have been following the budget process more than you might think for just a journeyman lawyer in Sacramento. I had a couple of issues to take with Fred's remarks. He said, and Gene pointed this out, he said there's no requirement for a balanced budget other than the governor propose a budget that is balanced. Actually, Prop 58 passed in March of
last year.
Right. Did require a balanced budget a little later in the process. It says that the legislature may not pass and the governor may not sign into law a budget that would appropriate from the general fund more than the general fund revenues estimated as of the date of the budget's bill passage. Estimated as of the budget bill's passage. So we go from the governor's estimate in January to the legislature's estimate at the time of the passage of the budget bill. And strange things happened last year, which was the first year which Prop 58 took effect. For example, there was a $400 million estimated revenue flow from a fraction of punitive damage awards being given to the state treasury. And everybody involved knew that that was a complete fiction because it only applied to lawsuits that would be brought after the effective date of the budget, and there would be nobody who would go to a judgment within the fiscal year and pay part of their punitive damages over to the state. And if they were that efficient bringing their lawsuit, they would settle, and there wouldn't be any punitive damages. So, but that was $400 million. It was just total fiction, but it was an estimate.
I stand by my original.
Okay. Let me go back to the beginning of my semi-prepared remarks. The topic is the state budget process part of the budgeting problem? Well, I guess I would just state that the state budget process, in the context of the political culture, the way it has developed in California and I dare say nationally, is broken. And it is broken to the extent that it led to the precipice of bankruptcy. People forget that we avoided bankruptcy as a state only by borrowing $15 billion in March of last year in order to just keep the state afloat, rolling over debt that would have become due in June of last year and would not have been, we simply would not have been able to pay that debt. And as Judith mentioned, the budget process was sufficiently broken that it drove the first recall of a governor in California's history. And I dare say that unless the business cycle is somehow magically repealed and we never have another recession, the budget process as it stands today will drive the state to the brink of bankruptcy again. It'll do that because, as Fred said, 83% of our spending is on autopilot. And I'll get to one of those autopilots in a second. It's actually a little bit more than that when you really think about it, because in the 17% are things like the state park system. So is anybody going to propose to close down the state park system? I'm not sure corrections is in the 83%, but is that 83%? There are a lot of really great things. The university system, a lot of really great things that are in the 17% that nobody really wants to cut either. And if it happens that, and there's no magical matching of revenues and expenditures. If these autopilot programs that we're committed to with the caseload growth, the cost of living allowances, the debt service we have on the $15 billion bonds, the retirement system, public employee retirement system that in times of the market being down, the state contributions have to go up in order to make the payments that are built into the existing retiree population. There's no matching of revenues and expenditures. And so I think we'll get to the brink of bankruptcy again. Just a point on autopilot spending. Proposition 98 is the biggest of the autopilots, the K-14 committed allocation of budget expenditures. That was an idea that was first proposed by Bill Leonard and myself as part of the 1983 budget process, because we were so frustrated that education was getting kind of the last dollar, the short shrift, because of all of the built-in cost of living increases for the welfare and health side of the budget. It was basically, in times of revenue shortage, schools got cut, and we thought the schools deserved at least as much guarantee of a piece of the budget pie as welfare recipients and Medi-Cal recipients. And so we thought it was just a nifty idea. George Duke Majan forced us to abandon that idea at the time, but it was picked up and made an initiative, and I think passed in, 1988? So there are really great motivations for all of the autopilot rigidities in the budget. Then the other factor, which Fred alluded to, is the incredible volatility of much of our revenue stream, especially the income tax stream. We have one of the most progressive income taxes in the country, and we have no lesser percentage tax for capital gains. So when the economy is humming along, we have capital gains, and when stock options are exercised, capital gains there that drives a huge. I think you have in your materials a little graph that shows the capital gains related income in the state of California. And we hit the wall when the NASDAQ crashed in March of 2001. I believe it was March of 2000. March of 2000. And I remember the budget director making a presentation to the California Chamber of Commerce in January of 2001, and that budget estimated that capital gains income would drop 10%. That was the balanced budget estimate of the Department of Finance. And I couldn't believe my eyes, because by then it had been 9 months of the market still tanking, and it was becoming evident that the dot-com crash was going to affect our economy. But that kind of volatility affecting with 83% of the budget at least on autopilot, and then we get to the political culture part. We've got polarization between the parties, and we've got paralyzed legislative leadership. And this is something that's gotten worse over the last 20 years. It probably started about the era of Prop 13. But the polarization is roughly like this. Republicans believe that the government is spending too much. At least this is what they tell their hardcore constituents. And they absolutely oppose any tax increases. Absolutely any tax increases, any fees. But they do go around saying, well, the governor's spending too much except for this and that. We think there ought to be more infrastructure spending. We think schools should get more spending. And we think teachers especially should get fair pay. The Democrats believe that the government is not spending enough. They want more for most of the programs. And they go around. Most of them will admit that they need tax increases to do that, but not all of them. And there are tax increase bills that have been on the floor of the legislature that don't get all the Democrats supporting them. So they talk a great game on the spending side, but don't really admit how much taxes would have to be increased to cover all their proposed spending. In fact, the Assembly Democrats just recently proposed the higher income tax increase, which doesn't cover the $3 billion shortchange of the education budget that they want increased. So they are essentially proposed an unbalanced budget. And the polarization is exacerbated by two other topics being covered today. One is redistricting. Almost all the districts are safe and extremely lopsided. So Republicans get elected by heavily Republican districts and never have to worry about a general election. And the same with Democrats on the other side. And then there's term limits. And the interaction of these two goes like this. The minute a Republican gets elected to the Assembly, he or she has to start thinking about the Senate seat that they're going to run for and the primary election in the Senate seat. And if you take the wrong position as a Republican in the legislature and try to be reasonable on something like taxes, I'm running out of time, you are going to be in political trouble. So I'm going to fast forward and say that there are, because of this political culture and because of and legislative leadership is paralyzed as well. I mean, the U.S. Senate recently confronted the judicial filibuster issue, and seven Democrats and seven Republicans got together and figured out a way to keep the filibuster for extreme cases and not filibuster all the judges. You can't find more than two or three people in either caucus in the legislature that would join a moderate bloc to form some sort of reasonable budget solution. You used to be able to find a lot more before the current redistricting and before term limits. So I think that the two reforms that are absolutely essential, and we'll have to get into this in the discussion period, they happen to be in the Live Within Our Means Act, otherwise known as LWOM, along with some other things, are that you need a spending cap that causes you to save some of the money in times of revenue peaks, put it aside, and allow it to be spent in times of revenue valleys. And you need a mid-year cutting authority for the governor, including, which is not included in the current blue pencil, abrogation of statutory auto spending measures. The proposal in LWOM is that there has to be a fiscal emergency, which means there has to be a 1.5% shortfall in revenues compared with the budget estimate. There's a quarterly review. The legislature's called into session to take a first cut at making the necessary cuts to balance the budget. If they fail, the governor on his own can make those mid-year cuts. Someone has to be able to act in the situation that we're confronting. The only adult on the block is going to be the governor. He or she is the statewide elected official. I dare say statewide elections are more representative than district-by-district elections. And while it is a huge shift of authority and very controversial, I don't think there's any other choice. At least I haven't thought of another idea that will avoid the precipice of bankruptcy. Thank you.
Like we're doing speed budget today, and I'll do a brief commercial announcement. If you want more on the process, we've put out a book called Dollars and Democracy, an Advocate's Guide to the State Budget Process, and their order forms out at the table. I have a board member, John Elwood, who teaches budgeting over in the Policy School at Berkeley, who whenever somebody says the budget process is the problem, quotes Rudy Penner, who was head of the Congressional Budget Office for many years, who said, the process isn't the problem, the problem is the problem. and I think that is a very accurate statement. And I think a lot of times we look at the process because the problem is too hard to change and too hard to address. So we come around and say, well, maybe if we change the process, we'll get better outcomes. And that said, I do think that the process does contribute to the problem in a number of ways, and some of them are ways that my co-panelists have touched on. I would single out the supermajority vote requirements for passage of a state budget and passage of any state tax increase. We're actually one of three states to require more than a majority under any circumstance. The other two are Arkansas and Rhode Island. I'm a Californian. I don't like to compare myself to either Arkansas or Rhode Island. We are one of 11 states to require a two-thirds vote for any state tax increase. And if you look at the other 10 and rank them in population, you have California, at about 35, 36 million people now. The next one in size is Washington State at about 5 or 6 million people. They're not states that have the tremendous diversity and the conflicts of interest that we have in California. And I think trying to get two-thirds of Californians to agree on anything is crazy to even think about. And it's particularly troubling to me that through the initiative process, voters impose two-thirds vote requirements by less than a two-thirds vote of the people who approved an initiative. And I know another one of my board members often says that there ought to be a rule that says that you cannot impose a supermajority vote requirement by a lower percentage than that requirement would be. And I think that's a reasonable thing to do. I think that to touch on how the majority, supermajority requirements contribute to the problem, and I think Fred touched on this in terms of talking about during the good times, you have Democrats that push for higher spending, you have Republicans that push for tax cuts. I always say when I speak, don't try this at home. If you increase your spending, you decrease your revenues, it's a recipe for disaster. And that is what happened during the late 1990s. What we've seen now is a backing out of a lot of the spending, the tax cuts, because, as Mr. Naylor said, of the really the hardline party discipline in the Republican Party, there has not been a permanent tax increase. We've had over $9 billion annual cost in tax cuts in the past decade. The VLF reduction alone, which now costs $4.5 billion, is equal to 75% of the state's long-term budget deficit. You could take care of 75% of the problem had the trigger mechanism put into that law in the beginning been allowed to take effect. Some would say that the attempt to have it take effect certainly fueled the recall, which is a longer discussion. The initiative process, again, a process issue that I think contributes to the problem. And I think it contributes in just a multitude of different ways. And one of the things that I find particularly troubling is that voters are allowed to approve spending that doesn't pay for itself, that goes on forever. They're not given the clear-cut choices. I mean, if you read the fine print that the analyst writes in the ballot pamphlet, they talk about it. Last year, voters approved $1 billion a year in spending, $300 million of which for the stem cell research bond. Voters say medical research, good thing. They're not asked the question, as these two were asked when they were elected to the Assembly, we have 300, you know, if we had $300 million extra to spend, would you rather have it go for stem cell research, which is sort of betting on a hunch, or would you want to take that $300 million and provide health coverage to every child in California? That amount of money would do it. I think I know what the legislature would have done given that choice, and I don't think it's necessarily what the voters had done. I think the voters might have made the choice had they been given a choice and said, you know, how would you rank order 1, 2, and 3? But that isn't the initiative process. And I think Mr. Jones' comments about sort of pay-to-play and people essentially buying money for interest through the initiative process is something that I find tremendously troubling. And another process issue that's part of the problem, and I think this is close to distinctly California, Oregon, Colorado, a few other states have similar problems, does go back to Prop 13, which people like me sometimes say is the root of all evil. But it is in ways that I think, you know, have a process impact that's important. California shifted so much of the responsibility for financing public services from local governments to the state, away from the level of government that's closest to the people, where people can directly participate, to the state budget. It means that when state elected officials make budget decisions, oftentimes, and this has been particularly true in this budget crisis, the implications of those decisions play out at the local level. I don't think those implications filter back to the state level very well. And I see legislators of both parties doing things like denying cost of living adjustments for the Child Protective Services program for 5 years because they don't see the impact of doing that. They don't see kids getting lost in the system. They don't see what happens when you don't provide cost of living adjustments in the foster care program for 5 years, and L.A. County is putting kids in office programs, office buildings, because they can't find foster care homes for them, and giving them Burger King vouchers to eat because of the impacts of budget and policy decisions. And that doesn't filter up particularly well. California, 25% of the combined state and local revenues come from the property taxes. Nationally, it's about a third. So it's a very big difference nationally. We don't have long-term planning in California. And I think this is one where there's probably a lot of bipartisan agreement. I'm not a big fan of a two-year budget for reasons people can ask me if they want. I do think California would be better served if we moved to something like the federal system that where CBO scores out for 5 and 10 years, and you can look at the long-term implications of both spending and revenue decisions. What you've seen, and I think that this plays on both sides, it's certainly a big factor with backloaded tax cuts. I think it's been a big factor in the impact of some of the pension changes that were made, particularly during the stock market boom. It's changes that had a very small, and the VLF cut, again, was a good example of this, small first-year implication, big out-year implication. And if you had a 5 or 10 year scoring, and sure, their estimates are hard, but at least it tells you, you know, this isn't very much this year, but it's this much 5 or 10 years from now. Live Within Our Means Act, because, again, I know we are in a tight time frame, so you all can participate. This is where you're going to see some disagreement. And I will say, and I've spoken on several panels, and Mr. Naylor gave the most honest explanation on the proponent's side that I've heard so far, and I really appreciate that. He particularly mentioned that the governor's extraordinary ability to cut applies when revenues fall below forecast, not when there's a budget deficit. If you had a prudent reserve, which I think is sort of in the 3 to 5% range, you could give the governor to cut anything, irrespective of the Constitution, irrespective of state law, if revenues fall 1.5% below forecasts. Revenue forecast, that's a drop in the bucket. That was within, you know, if you go back to your college statistics, that is well within, you know, sort of the one standard deviation from the estimate in California. You just can't forecast that well. If a finance director wants the governor to cut, they can construct a reasonable estimate that will give that power to a governor anytime they want to do it. It is far greater power than any governor anywhere in the country has. It's stunning in terms of the transfer of power. That ability to cut, and since the governor can veto any, yes, the legislature has a chance to act, the governor can veto that because of the notwithstanding the, any other provision of the Constitution language in LWOM, the legislature can't override a veto. So the governor really does hold all the marbles in this particular game. That ability to craft a budget by one individual also takes effect if there's a delay in the passing of budget. Budget not in effect by July 1. After 30 days, the governor declares a fiscal emergency. The old budget continues forward, and a governor in a bad year can cut however they want to cut. A lot of us think that will become the default mechanism for passing a budget. And again, that goes back to the two-thirds vote rule for doing that. LWOM also creates a new state spending limit. Doesn't get rid of the one that we've had since 1979. It creates a new one that applies to total state spending, doesn't define what total state spending is, so we don't really know what it applies to. And I think that's important, and if some of you caught an article in the LA Times earlier this week by Evan Halper on the impact of this measure on local government, there's a debate between local government officials and the governor and his staff right now as to whether or not LWOM applies to Prop 172 dollars, which is a sales tax rate that goes to local public safety dollars. The administration says, and this is going to be kind of technical, but this is, again, gets back to why I think making substantive policy through the initiative process is difficult. This is an important decision. The administration says, well, we define revenues for purposes of determining the inflation factor for this new spending cap, and we exclude Prop 172 from that calculation. So, therefore, when the spending cap applies, it won't apply to Prop 172. I would say, local government associations would say, but you don't define expenditures that are subject to cap. Therefore, this will be determined by the courts. I'll do one other sort of aside to talk about how complicated this measure is and why I don't think you can have an informed public discourse between next Monday and November 8th. When my organization did our analysis of this measure, I got the smartest minds from local government I could find, smartest minds in the legislature on the budget in a room, and we spent a couple of hours going through this measure. We came up with four ways you could diagram the algebra for the inflation factor of the spending cap. This is about 12, 13 people, four ways. There was sort of the way that most of us thought was the most plausible. The other three, if you just read it and then get down and remember back to, you know, high school algebra and try and – it's where you draw the parentheses in your algebra. But the difference is, in many years, do you have a 3% adjustment factor or a 6 to 10% adjustment factor? That makes all the difference in the world of whether or not this spending cap will actually apply. It also does a couple of other things that Mr. Naylor didn't mention. It permanently reduces by $4 billion a year the baseline funding level for K through 14 education. That translates on the K-12 side, because these are big numbers, to about $600 per student. And I think the final thing it does which is ironic because it's been put forward as a solution to autopilot spending, is it would put more spending on autopilot. And that's the Prop 42 transfer for transportation, and it would prohibit the state from raiding internal cookie jars to balance a budget. In my book, that may not be the greatest public policy, but the flip side is it may be better than going to the outside, and there, you know, sometimes there are some balances, and it just takes away two more tools that the legislature has currently to solve its problems. So if I could be queen for a day, what would I do? Majority votes for passage of a budget, passage of state tax increases. I would have long-term revenue and expenditure forecast be part of the budget. Something I would have talked about and should have talked about, I would integrate tax expenditure reporting into the budget process so that lawmakers see those trade-offs between taxes and spending. I would find some way to address the issue of initiative-driven spending. And I don't know whether that's through sunset date or something else, but I think we do need to get a handle on that as well. So thank you.
When we were trying to figure out who would go first in this particular format, we agreed we'd give the panelists just a couple minutes to respond, and then we'll open it up to questions. So I'm going to turn back to you.
Okay. Well, the 1.5% is not, it's about $1.2 billion. So if your revenues are falling $1.2 billion short of your forecast, you've got a potential problem. And if you have to wait until the following fiscal year, the following budget cycle to get a hold of that problem, you could have a lot worse than 1.5%. So it's trying to act early. I can't tell you how many special sessions there have been called to deal with fiscal issues in December and January, and nothing happens. And so somebody has to act, and you can't wait the whole fiscal year because the 1.2% you notice in September may be $5 billion quite easily by the time you – and that happened to Pete Wilson, it happened to George Dukmajian, and it happened to Gray Davis. I actually, while I support LWOM, I think there are some criticisms that are valid. I think there should be the possibility of veto override. I actually think the legislature should be able to act by a majority vote in response to the governor calling a special session. So he's dealing with a legislative response. On the two-thirds vote issue in general, I regard it as somewhat academic. Prop 56 proposed to lower the vote on the budget to 55% from two-thirds. It also proposed to lower taxes spent raised in connection with the budget to 55%. It was badly defeated. If you lower the vote on the budget to a majority and leave the taxes at two-thirds, and I guarantee you that's the hardest thing to pass the electorate. Now we have spending by a majority and the revenues to pay for the spending by two-thirds, that makes matters even worse than they are today. And I think I'll leave it at
okay,
that for,
good.
For now.
Jean, any final words before we go to questions?
I guess I'll say in the, and I think Fred said this in his, that there is a tendency, and I think that it certainly is, governors like to have good news in May. And that is a nonpartisan or bipartisan feature of public life. This year, and there's some complicating factors, but sort of the underlying economy revenue change between January and May was $4 billion. So I agree with Mr. Naylor. We're talking about a difference of $1.5 billion. This year, which is a pretty sort of a normal swing given the size of the budget between January and May, was $4 billion. So I do think, and again, I think it is to me, and this comes down to, and part of the mission of my organization is to encourage broader public participation in policy debates. It comes down to a fundamental separation of powers issue in government where, and I think Fred did a terrific job, the government in our current system, and this is the federal model, it's the state model, and it's the state model, I think, pretty much in all 50 states, although, no, actually Texas, the controller, does all kinds of wacky things. The governor proposes a budget. The legislative branch appropriates. In California, again, the governor has very broad powers for line item veto. This would take, and again, I think largely because of the two-thirds vote rule, it would shift really the power to appropriate back to the governor in many respects. And I think, and again, I think this governor, I think his predecessor, I mean, you know, it's, you can aim at both of them. I think the ability for ordinary Californians and advocates to reach a governor is much more difficult than it is for them to reach their local elected official. I think, again, we've seen two governors very much marked by, you know, a tremendous desire to fundraise incessantly, and I think that makes it much harder for people who can't buy the $20,000 dinner ticket to reach a governor. And I find the power shift aspects of this to be tremendously troubling as somebody who heads up an organization whose mission is to really speak for and look at issues and how they affect people who again, aren't always the ones that can hire the best lobbyists, the best law firms, and the best representation in Sacramento.
Great. Now, Fred, who was held back from making any real comments on the initiative, wants to jump in, and that's going to be the opening for questions right after
that. Very quickly, 3 points. One is a part of the feature in the last 25 years in California of the discussion around budgets, I think is quite interesting, and that is that there's essentially in the post-Prop 13 environment an entire generation of elected officials, almost all, meaning Republican and Democrat, where the notion of engaging in the revenue side discussion is considered sort of like, you know, bad middle-class manners or something. You know, you're just not supposed to really do that in polite company. And so it's considered either that or you're a damn fool. But it really is a part of a legitimate public policy debate to say, what are we managing towards in terms of, we want education to do what? We want transportation to do what? We want housing to do what? We want the environment how clean? Okay. To manage towards those objectives, that's going to cost this much, and we're going to lay the burden here, 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 and here. Is that a good thing, a bad thing, an indifferent thing? That's a much different debate than the one that is about the government's growing this fast on these natural, you know, features, and you know, we need to control it over here, and so on. That is a legitimate point of view, but it is far too narrow a public policy debate. But in the Prop 13 environment, that is where the debate sits. Is the debate sits over in that arena. Second issue, Gene made reference to the notion of tax expenditures needing to be displayed in the budget. If I could just talk for literally 1 minute about that. The legislature frequently enacts tax credits. A tax credit is an expenditure in the budget just as much as saying we're going to spend this much per pupil on education, we're going to do this in terms of TANF recipients, we're going to do this on transportation. Yet it is never displayed in the budget. So every time a tax credit is given to somebody because they manufacture blue pencils in California or whatever else it is, and I'm sure they all have merit to them, you are literally spending money because you are creating the legal fiction that somebody paid a tax they didn't ever pay. And so it has to be reflected in the expenditures of the state, but it is not displayed in the budget. Why is it not displayed? It's not displayed because it's the most shameful list of special interest giveaways you've ever seen in your life. And the legislature would be under enormous pressure, as would the governor, to justify it every year. Now, poor people have to justify why they, you know, need whatever, but the blue pencil manufacturers don't. Okay, so I'll get off my soapbox on that. Now, the last thing is this notion of where in these alleged or manufactured crises or bumps or whatever it is during the year you give the governor enhanced power or not. I'm not sure I'm so opposed to giving the governor enhanced power, provided the legislature gets enhanced power as well, because then what you're doing is you're giving enhanced responsibility to both sides of this deal. And we do still have, you know, a three-corner government with the legislative, judicial, and executive branches, and so, you know, if you're going to give the governor a little more power, the way to true up that game is to say that under those circumstances, when the governor has this enhanced power, the legislature can raise taxes by a simple majority vote. Now, I will tell you, when the legislature can do that and the governor can, you know, cut without playing around with the legislature, you now have, I think, the circumstances under which, because it is likely in the foreseeable future, the legislature will be Democrat. California is unlikely to change that. With term limits or redistricting or anything else, it's going to be a Democrat legislature likely into the foreseeable future. Governors are going to be Republican, Democrat, or whatever. But I think if you just sort of understand that part of it or accept that part of it, then it does make sense to say it's not a bad idea to have some midterm, mid-course, mid-year, fiscal year correction ability built into the system, aside from what it is now, because really it's very weak or non-existent right now. But you could enhance that, but I think everybody needs to get enhanced. Otherwise, it becomes virtually a slicing, dicing, cutting, you know, pain-distributing exercise as opposed to anything else.
Okay, great. Now you hear the beginning of the debate that's likely to open up after Monday, but let's open it up to questions. Yes, right here in front.
I appreciate Jean's comments because she said many things that I said in my brief time next door, that the initiative process is out of control, the mandates, et cetera, and the majority vote in the budget. And one particular thing I didn't get to say there is Wilson in 1991, in less severe times, put in the 10 and 11% bracket. The Democrats can't convince any Republicans and are afraid to even address the subject. And when 98% of the people don't pay it, you'd think it'd be the benefit to raise revenues to provide services. And I contend even in Republican districts that people should be telling them, we need the services, vote for the taxes.
Okay. Fair enough. Good. We'll get back here.
As Republican as I am, and as much as I salute the anti-tax philosophy, the voters are not nearly as polarized as the elected officials. I mean, they vote to increase their own taxes all the time, especially in transportation in recent years, by a two-thirds vote because they see the money needs to be spent. And the polling shows that the public is willing to raise certain kinds of taxes. It's always the taxes that don't affect them particularly, and they are for additional services, and there's not necessarily a match between the tax revenues they're willing to raise and the services they want, but they are not as polarized as the elected legislators.
I would say it's largely the credit of Bill Jones, who brought along a reluctant Republican caucus that in 1991 that was enacted, and I think he did a tremendous job.
And Bob Naylor brought along, for a triggered sales tax increase, a reluctant caucus in 1983.
There you have it. Okay, did you have it right there? Yeah.
Well, the short answer to that is the legislature needs to actually negotiate something with the governor and put it on the ballot, and I actually hope that happens as opposed to LWOM. But and if that doesn't happen, then somebody has to raise a lot of money and pay those signature gatherers to the measure on the ballot, because almost all the things we've talked about, not all of them, but a lot of them, would require constitutional amendments.
Just to remind folks, in the last election, right, the cities and counties got together, they qualified an initiative, and then everyone, the governor and legislators and local governments got together, and they came up with Prop 1A. And so Prop 1A went through, and there was actually another initiative on the ballot, but at the point, once 1A went on, that had no support. And so that's basically what's being suggested as a possibility here. Okay, other questions, comments?
Yeah. I'm wondering why the legislature can't – why is it that the voters have such large discretion to spend so much money, and why can't the legislature pass a law to cap the amount of money being spent in initiatives? Like, why isn't there – why do the voters get to decide what 40% of the money is spent on education when they really don't know, you know, what the other issues are that need money?
Thank you, Hiram Johnson.
it is a function of the reforms in the beginning of the 20th century. Hiram Johnson advanced, and whatever his intent might be, the use of it 110 years later or 100 years later is the one that was described by Mr. Secretary in the opening plenary session. And I think that it is, although it's an interesting discussion to have, I think it is entirely unlikely that the voters would be inclined in any way to limit, because it would take a constitutional amendment to limit the powers of referendum, initiative, and recall in California. I think they cherish that. They value that. I think they do see that, even when they may recognize or believe that it has been hijacked or abused or whatever it might be, that it is still the people's power that they reserve unto themselves, and will want to continue to do that. So I think that's the reason.
So it's in the Constitution. You'd have to change it, which means you'd have to go to the voters who love the process.
And let's say, hypothetically, you could persuade the voters to put in the Constitution a limit on how much spending can happen by initiative. The next initiative to come along will make an exception.
Amendment to the Constitution for that limit. Okay, right here in the middle.
I mean, I can give you an estimate that'll go from 60% to 95% in terms of what I think is locked in. And again, the 1783 split, which is sort of, I guess, sort of in the midpoint of where we would come down, doesn't include the University of California, doesn't include the state park system, doesn't include legislature, doesn't include a lot of very core functions. I think when you look at where there is practical room to move, it's pretty small. And again, I think live within our means would lock in Prop 142. I do think people get frustrated because of that. I think it does limit choices. I think on the revenue side of the budget, people would identify as sort of the easy money revenue increases have been picked off. Tobacco tax increases, which for better or worse have been done in a lot of other states, certainly the 1% tax rate for mental health approved in last November, would have been probably the more voter-friendly revenue options. And again, those have gone into new programs rather than solving the fiscal problems in the ones we already have.
From my perspective, there's also another aspect to this, and it goes like this. My point on the 80 fill in the blank percent predetermination is this. If it is true that you can reach agreement fairly quickly between the legislature, the governor, the Republicans, the Democrats, the Senate, and the Assembly on 85% of the spending, and I do believe you can do that fairly quickly. The 15% is what the debate is about. The 5% is what the debate is about, the whatever. Now, here's the problem with ballot box budgeting, in my judgment. What it does is it erodes that debate. Now, our current governor said, you know what a great thing to do when he was merely an internationally branded product and not the governor of the state of California? He said, you know, it would be a wonderful thing if kids had a place to go before school and after school, and wouldn't this be wonderful? And everybody said, of course that's wonderful. Now, I'll tell you, you can show up, and the voters passed it and said, let's make that wonderful thing happen. Now, I'll tell you, you can show up in Sacramento any day of the week, and there are 5,000 good ideas, equally as good as those ideas, as the idea of doing something good for kids before and after school. There's thousands of those good ideas. What those ideas have to do is compete with each other during the budget process for that 5% or 15% or 2% or whatever of discretionary spending that the governor and the legislature really have. The problem with ballot box budgeting isn't that we don't get good ideas put on the ballot and passed by the voters. They're great. They simply don't compete with anything, and they're done extra contextually. It's not a helpful thing to adopt them.
I'm
from Santa Cruz. Just came from that. I don't know what it even means.
Okay.
But I think that's the problem with ballot box budgeting because that idea, let's say the governor's idea of before and after school, let's say that at the time he proposed it when he wasn't governor, that it was the single most important, most popular thing that could have possibly been done of 100,000 ideas, fine. The next year, it should still have to compete with all the other ideas because the world changes all the time and something else is going to be the most important, and I think that needs that flexibility to do that.
Okay. Over here.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think so.
Can you imagine any political climate that would make it possible to even modify, much less repeal Prop 13? And would that be a good idea?
Well, you know, I will say one thing just from the conversations we've been having is that if you take people off the record, you get very different answers than you get when they're on the record because there's quite a bit of discomfort with it, but that's different than how it's perceived politically. And so there's this interesting question of whether the off-the-record ever becomes the reality.
Well, a modification that I think stands a chance is the split role. Now, I and my law firm will be happy to see that qualify and doing the legal work for the no campaign. But I do think that there I don't think you're going to touch the 1% limit on residential property. I do not think you're going to be able to. You're not going to be able to give local city councils and school districts the ability to raise residential property taxes just because they need some additional money. I don't think the state is going back to that. But regular reassessment of commercial property is an idea that might fly. It would be a huge campaign, but I think that's. And I'm not advocating it, but you asked.
I would agree with that. One of the things I thought was particularly telling on this topic on the residential side is we were part of an effort now some years back, but I doubt if it would have changed, to conduct a poll where people were asked, do you think Prop 13 was good for California, bad for California? Of the people who thought it was bad for California, 60% said they'd vote for it again. So, again, I think it's one of these cases there. You know, it's like we know it. It's, you know, why do people eat things they shouldn't eat? Because they like to. It's in their self-interest. But they would go ahead and do it again. I do think the commercial property, I think you'll see that in the ballot within the next 5 to 10 years, and I think it'll be one of the biggest spending campaigns you've ever seen in California.
But okay, by the way, to add very quickly onto that notion, I agree with them on that notion that it may be there. I think another interesting feature that I hope would be debated as part of getting something to the ballot is this question. When is a sale that triggers the reassessment of Prop 13? For example, when Compaq bought Tandem. No, when they bought Tandem computers in Cupertino. That was a sale, just like when I sold my house to somebody. Yet because of the nature of the way that sale took place, Larry Stone, the assessor in Santa Clara County, didn't go out and send a new tax bill, so they enjoyed the original basis. It was every bit a sale. Just ask the shareholders, just ask the employees, just ask anybody else. It was a sale, but it didn't trigger it under Prop 13. So I think that would be another interesting part to have a debate on is when is a sale.
So since we're getting short on time and we have a lot of hands, I'm going to ask a couple people to ask their questions so the panelists can respond in an effort to get as many voices in as possible right here in front.
To create a tax credit requires a 50% vote. To repeal that tax credit requires a 2/3 vote because it's deemed a tax increase, which seems to me kind of nutty. Would you support a proposal that would say that they have to be created and repealed by the same percentage, either 50% or 2/3?
Okay, I'm going to take another question, too, just so the panel can respond in the back. Okay. We'll put the address up here. I want to put it right up here so people can see it. It's next-10.org, and I do recommend it as a way to get information, but let's move on to other questions in the way back right there on the wall.
Thousands and thousands of lobbyists are up there after the money or after moving the market for their benefit to take the business away from somebody else. I think that this needs to be looked at a little bit more from the perspective of the consumer and the market outside of the legislature rather than figuring out how to pick our pockets to take more money for somebody's special interest. Let's start looking at some policies that are going to positively impact California and our economy and generate some more taxes. Make us more healthy.
Okay, I'm going to go to responses to the question here and the comment in the back about the equal voting for both tax expenditures and tax cuts.
I wouldn't mind seeing a 2/3 vote for a tax credit and a 2/3 vote to repeal it. I'm at the 2/3 level. But I do think his point that it is an expenditure. It takes a 2/3 vote to appropriate money in an appropriation bill except for education spending, so I don't see why you should have a different rule for tax credits.
Are we in agreement?
Yeah.
Okay, that's an interesting point. Okay, sure. Other hands.
I thought you'd go majority both ways.
I was saying agreement on the same requirement.
Oh, the same requirement. Okay.
Oh, I'm glad you clarified that because I was a little
same
shocked.
Requirement.
I thought you were also saying
I'd go majority.
Okay.
Fred, you want to say something?
I could literally take it either. At a philosophical level, don't think there ought to be anything other than majority votes on anything ever because my vote ought to count the same amount as Mr. Naylor's does if we're both in the legislature. I wasn't elected to be a junior partner, and he wasn't elected to be a junior partner. We represent 400,000 people each. My vote counts for them. His vote counts for them. That's the way it ought to be. Otherwise, it's undemocratic. Having said that, I'm agnostic on, you know, whether it's 2/3 or a majority. Philosophically, everything ought to be a majority, but as long as it's the same, to get the thing in and get the thing out, it's, you know, fine.
Okay. I'm going to take two questions, and that's going to be it right over here and over there.
Okay. You were talking about competing interests and good ideas. How do some of the single-issue constituents, like taking prison guards, for example, in the budget, in the third rail of their salaries, I don't know, went from under, really from 17.5 to, what, they got a 50% pay increase a couple of years ago. How does that play into the budget process, and what should be done about it?
Okay, and next question over here. Go ahead.
You talked about, Mr. Keeley did, about looking at the both the revenue and the spending side, and one of your examples was the concept of saying, what is it? What are the services we need? Then start from scratch. How do we pay for them? We're starting to be challenged by that in the area of education because of the Williams case about are we providing an adequate education. There's been some political wishy-washiness about whether we'll take that challenge. What would you say is the impact on the budget process? Will it go from education to anywhere else?
Okay, so we have two questions related to two different issues. Anybody?
I'd like to take that one. I think Gene Ross had the best solution for that prison guard example, and that is a five-year projection. I dare say that people who approved the MOU in the legislature, that's memorandum of understanding that had that pay increase, didn't have a clue what the second, third, and fourth year impact of that is, and it's hundreds of millions of dollars. It is, you know, it's a budget breaker that they couldn't afford, but it's passed, and a lot of the retirement benefits get passed on the same level. On the,
pardon me, Mr. Mailer, but with term limits, I don't think that's going to matter to the legislature anyway.
I would disagree. I actually would disagree from the outside on that. I think that the example at hand is one where I really think it would have mattered.
Most legislators see themselves as being in the legislature 12 years between the Assembly and the Senate. So.
Can we also address the question that was raised here about education? Go ahead, Gene.
Go ahead.
Very quickly on the contracts issue, how that actually works is that the Department of Personnel Administration is, under the law, vested with the authority of negotiating the public employee contracts that are in the state government sector. And they do that at the direction with the approval of the governor. The governor is then required to submit that for an up or down vote embodied in a bill. They take the memorandum of understanding between the bargaining unit of labor and the administration, what they have agreed to. That memorandum of understanding is put exactly the way that was negotiated into a piece of legislation, and it's an up or down vote on the floor. You cannot say, oh, we don't think the prison guard should get so much. If you think that, then don't pass the thing. And that's the way it works. Now, that may, and I will tell you, you do not want to turn contract negotiations over to 120 legislators. And that's not a good idea either. But those packages come in, are, to use the federal term, scored. The Department of Finance and alleged analysts put a number on them. There is an analysis done by all kinds of folks that explain this to you, and then ultimately it becomes whether or not the legislature wants to go along with that and, in effect, pre-budget that out for the future term of the contract. And maybe they do and maybe they don't, but that's how those things happen.
I'll speak quickly to both. And I think certainly, again, if you look at some of the pension changes, a lot of times those were in lieu of, and I think the facts are fairly clear, in lieu of salary increases for state workers, which had a one-year cost, so instead you trade multi-year costs. And again, I think, you know, and you can guess and speculate as to how the votes might have come down. I think, again, if you give a longer forecast horizon, you have a better debate on the specifics. With respect to Trudy's question, I think it is important to begin to look at what the state does. And I think having gone through a five-year budget crisis, what you see is, I think, a very undermining a lot of the basic systems in California. And a lot of times, those basic systems, I talked a little bit to foster care, to child protective services, don't have the constituencies of what I would call some of the boutique programs. And it's, if you go up and listen to the conference committee, it's fascinating because you will hear 45 minutes of debate on a, with due respect to both my colleagues, some members' pet program that cost $1 million, and they'll do, you know, the foster care budget, which is $600 million, like that. And I think that, again, some of that is term limits. I think a lot of it does come down to term limits, but we need to look at How do we measure effectiveness? What do we do? How do we look at the core integrity of programs? And in education, certainly the debate around categorical, which is sort of earmarked spending, and we have a whole bunch of teeny tiny programs because somebody had a great idea for a bill, either a constituent or a legislator, and we're not funding sort of the bedrock reading, writing, and arithmetic at a level that's competitive to what's going on in the rest of the country. And I don't know how you get there. Inadequacy for education, there's some really interesting models in other states that involved bringing parents, teachers, community members together to talk about Ohio and Wisconsin are the two I'm aware of. What do we want our schools to look like, and then how do we begin to pay for that?
Okay, with that, I'm going to ask you to spend the next couple minutes answering the second page of your pink sheet that you got when you came in. These will be used later on today, and so if you'd spend the next couple minutes, then after that we'll be done. Thank you very much. Thank you very much to our panelists as well.